Chatter on Books. It's Cliff Notes for book clubs. Why read the book if you can listen to Chatter on Books? I'm Jamie McIntyre, your announcer, but you don't care about that. Here again is your host, Tori Clark.
Awesome. Thanks, Claude. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Chatter on Books. Hope everybody's doing well and staying healthy. As Claude and I were just talking, 1 hour you hear good news about the COVID-19, and then an hour later you hear scary news, but hope everybody's doing well. And in just a little bit, we are going to be talking to Rebecca Sachs, who has a really interesting career of doing a lot of good work and a lot of interesting writing. And her first novel is called City of a Thousand Gates. It is about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict through the eyes and lives of a very diverse cast of people. It is enthralling, gripping. If they don't make a Netflix series of this, they won't make a Netflix series about anything. Joining us tonight, Claude, doing all the important work. David Aldridge is back with us after taking care of his high school. And welcome back, Chuck Culpepper. Glad you're with us.
Thank you so much. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. How are you and how much traveling have you been doing lately?
Oh, I'm so-so. Isn't everyone kind of so-so?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you've probably been in airports more than the rest of us.
I did. I have counted. So I've been in, I've had 30 flights.
Wow.
During the pandemic, 30 segments and 54 hotels, 25 states and zero haircuts. So I'm obviously accustomed to answering that question. You know,
I think a haircut might be more coronavirus safe than all those airports.
Oh, that's, that is just a tells how odd we are as a species that certain things we're avoiding, but you know, I've been in on 30 flights.
Yeah. Wow. And you haven't had COVID
so far. I'm one of those people who thinks I had it from this nightclub in New York, early March 2020. Yeah. And my friend who was there got it. So I must have had it, but I don't know.
Wow. All right. Well, we're thrilled you're with us. We've got several things to get to tonight before we get to Rebecca. We have a couple of emails, which I want to read. They're both for David and Chuck. But so today's President's Day, which caused me to look up something because I was trying to find this book about George Washington. And I learned something I never knew, which is, so it's President's Day, which covers Lincoln and Washington, right? Mm-hmm. Lincoln, February 12th. Well, they say George Washington's birthday is February 22nd, a week from today. So they kind of collapse the two and you get today, the 15th, which is when we're taping the show. Did you guys know that George Washington was actually born on February 11th?
And did not know that.
I did not know that. According to the then used Julian calendar, he was born in 1731. In 1752, however, this is from Wikipedia, so it must be true. It
can't be wrong then.
In 1752, Britain and all its colonies adopted the Gregorian calendar, which moved Washington's birthday a year and 11 days to February 22nd, 1732. And no surprise, I think a lot of people evidently kind of said, no, that's not a good idea. And George Washington was whatever. So that's why his birthday is February 22nd. Wow. But the book I was trying to find, and I could not find, and I want somebody listening to this show to find it for me. I thought it was called The Last Farewell or The Last Ride or something like that. It's this wonderful little book about George Washington's trip. He wins the Revolutionary War and he does the famous address. He leaves New York and he heads home to Mount Vernon. Mm-hmm. And he had been telling Martha for months, I'm coming home. And Martha's like, buddy, there are a lot of things to do back on the farm. Get your ass home. And it was mostly his letters to her. And there were just so many. He had to keep stopping. One of the reasons the trip took so long, he had to keep stopping because all these British loyalists who were not on his side during the war all of a sudden wanted to thank him and throw parties for him. And it took him a long time. And he had to keep sending letters to Martha saying, I'm on my way. I got to go to one more party, that kind of thing. Most wonderful little book. And I couldn't find it. I Googled it 18,000 different ways. So maybe I imagined it, which has happened to me before. If any one of the 50,000 people listening to this podcast knows what book that is, email us at info@chatteronbooks.com and I'll send you a mug. Because if I don't get rid of the 300 mugs in my basement, my husband is going to be really mad. Okay, emails, sporty emails for David and Chuck.
Oh, no.
Yeah, sporty emails. No, this is kind of interesting, and I have not thought of this. This is from Mia in Grosse Pointe, Michigan. I know Grosse Pointe.
I know. They made a movie about it and everything.
Great movie.
Very great movie. Awesome.
Great movie, yeah. Yes. But it wasn't really about Grosse Pointe.
It wasn't. It could have been anything.
Okay. David and Chuck, we're a year into the pandemic and still very few fans have attended professional sports events. Mm-hmm. Some players seem to care. Some seem not to care, other than perhaps the loss of revenue. As journalists who cover these events, how does the no fan scene affect your work, if it does at all? And question number two, what's your bet on the Olympics this summer? Will they take place with or without fans? Okay, alphabetic order. Chuck, you go first.
I find the events, frankly, a tad depressing. And I have realized all anew that that the fans were all along were a major part of it, as annoying as the traffic. Oh, I would love some annoying traffic going to the stadium. They held the Kentucky Derby and the Super Bowl, both of which I went to, but they did not hold the Kentucky Derby or the Super Bowl. They just called them that because both of them are about shoulder to shoulder, aggravating, awful crowds that I really miss.
Yeah. So. Do you think it seeped in, that sadness would seeped into your coverage?
I think so.
Yeah.
Had to.
David?
Well, let's see. I did a handful of football games this year. Almost all of which were, it was one that where they had like 4,000 people in there or something like that. And I did want two baseball games in empty stadiums. And it was bizarre. It was bizarre.
Do you find it almost distracting? Do you find the quiet almost distracting?
Yeah. Yeah. Because you're used to that hum. I know Chuck knows what I'm talking about. There's a hum at sporting events that you just get used to. You've been doing it for 30 years. There's just this hum of expectation that something's going to happen that's going to require them to stop speaking to the person next to them for 5 seconds and cheer or boo or do something that fans do.
Right.
And the fact that they're not there, and it's not that they are they important? Yes. Are they necessary? I don't know if they're necessary, but they are very important, I think. And it is not the same event without fans. And the players that I've talked to have played games in empty stadiums have all said the same thing. I'm sure Chuck said the same thing. It's just not the same.
Yeah.
It's just not the same. It's just weird. Because it's you're so used to that call and response from fans to tell you you're doing well or you're doing poorly. Or if you're the visiting team, you're doing well, so we're going to try to boo you and intimidate you. And that makes a lot of visiting players play better, you know?
Yeah.
So. Yeah,
I watch hockey more than anything else on television. And I must say, and the teams have gotten very good at the fake fan noise.
Yes.
Got very good at the time and all that. But still, when the play is actually underway, you can hear the players, which is just spectacular. It really is fun. It's very fun to listen to. And even when they get to the bench, they haven't quite figured out how to catch up to that. I think it's pretty great.
Yeah. It's I'm glad they're doing it because we need something, but I do miss the fans.
So, David, will there be fans at an Olympics this summer?
I don't know if there's going to be an Olympics this summer. I mean, honestly, I really don't know. I mean, I know Tokyo's talking big and bold now that we're having it. Nothing's going to stop us, really.
I mean, right.
You know, who can say that with any degree of confidence right now? So we'll see. I think you will see very different Olympic teams, whether it's whether it's the United States team or other teams around the world than you would normally see. And I don't know how that's going to impact the competition because I don't know enough about judo to know who the best judist in the world is. You know what I mean? I just don't know. So I have no idea. It will affect the competition for sure.
Yeah. Chuck, what do you think? Olympics? And if they have them, will you go?
I'll give it a very narrow yes on the first one and a definite yes on the second one. And I've been watching a lot of Australian Open the last few. Mm-hmm. And, that's an event it's one sport, but it's every day for 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like something it's got a lot of pressure on it to measure up.
Right.
It's also in a place that takes the virus so seriously that they just ran the fans out of there, the fraction of fans, 30%, because they had 13 cases in the state of Victoria, 13. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what Japan's posture will be on that, but I would say yes, enough vaccinations and fraction of fans.
Probably. Yeah, but I saw Simone Biles being interviewed the other day. She's hilarious in so many ways and fabulous. You just think about, you guys know this better than I do, but the intensity with which athletes have to train for Olympics. And they really have, they have a sequence of things they want happening. They want places they want to be physically and otherwise in the months and years leading up to.
Sure.
And to be told last year, oh, nope. Wait a year.
Yeah.
Now, Claude and I were talking, before the show, things this time last year that it never occurred to us they wouldn't be scheduling in 2021. We now go, maybe not.
Yeah.
Just be psychologically, it'd be so tough.
Oh, yeah. It's devastating because they live in 2 and 4 year cycles and they have to stick to that routine. Yeah. And when it's disrupted in such a serious manner, I mean, it really does, because you're trying to peak, you know, you're trying to peak your time, your performance, so that you're at your absolute best at a world championship or an Olympic year. And this was not supposed to be one of those for a lot of sports. Yeah. So
slightly different reasons, of course, but I knew a woman who was going to be on a team, US team, for the 1980 Olympics. And she didn't go because of the boycott.
Right.
She was changed forever.
Sure.
And not in a good way.
No,
not
sure. No, I understand that. Yeah.
Was changed forever.
Absolutely.
It was something. Okay. Happier topic. And it's this stage when our authors, if they're listening, Chuck, they're listening to the show, they're going, am I on the right show? So I'll pretend this is about
books. No, I'm still drinking.
We did say it's about books and drinks. So I was reading the New York Times the other day, and I've reached an age where there's seldom something I read that I don't know something about. I never know much about anything, but it's seldom I read something and go, I had no idea that even existed. So this is in the technology section of the New York Times. It's called Tech Tip by J.D. Beersdorfer. Has anybody on the show ever heard of commonplace books?
Not until you sent me the email.
Chuck?
I've never heard of the phrase before, but I had one for many years. It was full of Stephen Wright jokes.
Hallelujah. Okay, let me just read this line, and then you can explain your close personal experience with commonplace books. So it goes on. This is all about taking your commonplace book and making it digital, because we're so digitally adept. But anyways, it says the commonplace book is not a new concept. Copying your favorite lines from other people's works into your own annotated notebook was a standard exercise in Renaissance Europe, and the idea can be traced to the Roman era. So I'm sorry, we've been plagiarizing since the Roman era, Chuck?
Well, I didn't ever use it. I just read them for inspiration sometimes.
All right, I have to know what your favorite Stephen Wright joke is, because I have one, but what's yours?
Wow. So many to choose from. Whether it's some people are afraid of heights, I'm afraid of widths. Or because I was a C-section, I liked his joke about how I was a C-section. There have been no problems except when I leave the house, I go out through the window. But there's so many.
My favorite is I have a map of the United States, actual size. 1 mile equals 1 mile.
Okay, Chuck, do you physically right hand write your?
I don't do it anymore, but I did it for a long time. Say
what years of your life?
I would say age about 18 to 30, maybe. Wow. So, you know, five years ago. No.
And do you have them all somewhere?
Yes, in a storage unit.
Okay.
And you reminded me that my friend Grace from childhood had an entire, what are we calling them? Commonplace books. Van Halen commonplace book. Anything at school that was said about Van Halen went in there. And our favorite quote was her dear, dear mother, who said, David Lee Roth has such sensuous lips. And I haven't thought about that in years. So this whole thing is about that time.
All right. Well, if you read JD's piece, it's all about how you can digitize it and you can put it in your notes. And then
I never did that. I never have done that.
No.
I've written down quotes every once in a while, but not in any type of organized form.
No, I wrote down now I have to find it. Rebecca is on the West Coast, so she hasn't gone to bed yet. And I'm sure she's hanging in with us. Let me see if I can find it. I believe it's a John Madden quote. Oh, I hope I can find it.
When the equals to feet.
No. Oh, no. Here's a good one, though. This is by Herb Brooks, Miracle on Ice. We are temporary caretakers of this sport. What matters is we leave it better than we found it. I think that's lovely. I think that's a life saying.
Yeah.
That's my entire commonplace book right there. That's it. Okay. Claude, is Rebecca still with us, or is she giving up on us?
I would.
Yeah, I would too.
She's there. She's muted right now without the video on, so her name's
there. Being very John Sayles. Hi, yes. Rebecca.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So, Rebecca, I'd like you to meet, at least in the order of my screen, Claude Jennings, doing everything that's important. Chuck Culpepper, who's fabulous despite not having a haircut in a very long time. Mm-hmm. David Aldridge. Everybody say hi to Rebecca.
Hello, Rebecca.
Hello.
Hi, Rebecca.
Grab a drink. We have.
There we go. Rebecca, you on the West Coast? Is it sunny and warm where you are?
It's sunnier and warmer than where you are.
Oh, I know. Again, just wet feet all the time. Okay, let's talk a little bit about you and then talk about your fabulous book, City of a Thousand Gates. Here's what I know. Dartmouth, UC Irvine, program in writing. You worked at Vanity Fair and other places and wrote for the Paris Review. You moved to Tel Aviv to get a master's in Jewish studies. What got you to all those places? Where are you from originally? What did you want to be when you were five? Did you have a commonplace book? Because I've never heard of these before.
I didn't know they were called commonplace books, although I've long written out in my own journals sentences, paragraphs, whole chapters of books I admire.
Wow.
Where
do you keep yours?
Actually, this is so convenient. I have stacks of journals. So this is like maybe, let's say 3 years worth.
Wow. So. Okay. They'll be in a library someday.
I mean, my parents' basement, sure. I was born in the States, in New York. I lived in New Jersey, but I came of age in Ottawa, Canada, where my parents still live, which kind of really set me off, I think, in the right direction. If the right direction for a writer is always feeling a little like an outsider, it was like perfect. I was the Canadian in America, the American in Canada,
man without a country, woman without a country, sort of.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I guess my whole life just sort of following curiosity and trying to make a living sort of led me.
Those two seldom go together. Very seldom go together.
Yes, that is, I have found, I can speak from experience that is true. It's amazing now to be in this position where I really am making a living from what I love, certainly the first time in my life I could say that. I think writing felt almost like a very expensive hobby for most of my life, because all the jobs I had, ostensibly maybe they would seem like writing, like when I was at Vanity Fair, but that was mostly working with an editor, or when I was living in Israel, and I was definitely writing for like the Paris Review or all these like wonderful literary publications, the millions, but like what really paid my bills was definitely writing like an in-flight magazine for which I was like please don't use my pilot. That was like my one stipulation.
Alan Smithy production.
So right, if that gave you the freedom to write the things you wanted to write about.
Yes.
Okay. So, but it's absolutely okay. Yeah, and you've written about so many different things, which is, it's going to be a long convoluted way of getting us to your book, City of a Thousand Gates. But you wrote a lot of different things from Tel Aviv, which makes a lot of sense. But you also wrote about the Rockettes. You wrote about luxury hotels for dogs and cats, which I'll be looking up pretty soon. Food, coins from antiquity, right? All sorts of different things. So yes, you clearly can cover anything, and you have A to Z. And despite the fact that literally tens of thousands of books have been written about the Middle East, you decide this is going to be your first novel. Why?
I think a lot of my writing starts as me trying to maybe explain something to myself. Like that's like a really early draft. It's like me telling a story to myself, or me making something legible that I've sensed but haven't quite been able to articulate. And that was a lot of my writing when I moved to Tel Aviv and then later lived in Jerusalem and, you know, and I was spending so much time in Israeli homes and in Palestinian homes and really becoming aware not just of like the rhythms of domestic life in other cultures, but also the ways in which those intimacies and domesticities were like so shaped by persistent, constant political violence. So all of this is happening around me, and it's very new for a girl from Ottawa, Canada. And so I was sort of explaining a lot of this to myself, articulating it to myself. What in really small ways at first, you know, these sort of short essays. What is your routine like if your routine is patterned by war, essentially? Yeah. And I think so I it started in nonfiction. And the nice thing about writing essays is like you are explaining something to yourself and to a reader at the same time. Mm-hmm. So great. Or at least for me, that's how it works for me when I write essays. But with fiction, there's a kind of like another layer of narration that happens. So in my first drafts, maybe I'll be telling the story to myself, but in later drafts, I'll start to think about how am I communicating this to a reader? How can I give a reader information that I've learned without making it explicit? How can I sort of like tacitly convey a world to them that mm-hmm. they might not be familiar with, or the consequences of different languages being spoken and what it means when one language is spoken and not another, or when Hebrew is spoken but with an Arabic accent? What does that mean about how the people in these scenes are being read? And I think I felt less like I was taking on the project of writing any kind of like definitive account of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, and more that I was doing something that was almost the opposite, which was conveying the deep, personal, intimate lives of people who are essentially normal, meaning yeah. not political actors, not individuals who wield great power.
Nobody famous.
Nobody famous.
Yeah. Except it is 28. We should tell people. I never do this enough to let the authors give the elevator pitch. But
Yes. Right,
go ahead. Give us the 30-second elevator pitch.
All right. The 30-second elevator pitch is. I think I'm supposed to say the word kaleidoscopic. Hold on.
It's a yes. great All word. Right. And I kept trying to find other words to describe your book and I couldn't because
No, it's work. You got to. It's inevitable. So it is a it's set in the modern day West Bank, so and largely in Jerusalem, and it is indeed or attempts to be a kaleidoscopic view of the intersecting lives of Palestinians and Israelis and foreigners as they all react to two very tragic, consequential events.
Yeah, which it's not giving anything away. Two young people, one Jewish, one Palestinian, are horribly, horribly killed,
yes.
Which is something that has happened. There are so many characters in this. I keep saying it's almost like characters in a play. There are 28 people that you're working with in the book, right? So much so that you have a directory in the front.
Yes.
Which I
they made me feel like a great Russian novelist to have a directory of characters.
Well, I thought I was going to need it, but I didn't, because the stories are just so gripping. Mm. I'm going to get this wrong, but it's almost as though I'm making the stories very real. I mean, these people are trying to go through their lives the way, well, not David and Chuck and I, because we're losers, but people just trying to get through their lives and trying to have lives and have loves and have children. That starts to really explain the magnanimity of what's going on in that region. And so it's almost by getting smaller, you made this very big and very, very important. But as I was reading it, and I found it easy to find, again, I didn't have to use the directory, but I saw a tweet, I think it was from an interview you had done. Can you explain what your room looked like when you were writing this book?
Oh my goodness.
It looked like laundry lines and the index cards, and I couldn't tell if they were little binder clips or clothespins, but
they're miniature clothespins. I keep that industry afloat, the miniature clothespin industry. I didn't know, yeah, there was such a thing until I needed it. But yeah, I mean, there were real logistic concerns to writing a book where I wanted to be so intimate and so inside each character's point of view and life, and yet also to be able to begin to bring it all together and let their lives intersect, and one character is in another character's story, and I have to keep track of all the events happening in the background. So I developed an increasingly intense idiosyncratic system to both keep myself organized and immersed at the same time, essentially. So yes, as you mentioned, it involves I put nails in the wall and then nice. I affix like mailing twine to them, essentially. So I have these clotheslines, And then little pieces of paper get attached. So when I'm composing, it would be sentences written on these very thin, sort of elegant sheets of planner paper. There's no need for me to be that fussy. Honestly, I just like when things are pretty. So that's the reason for that. I could use anything. I want it to feel, special. Nice. And
that's okay.
So when I'm composing, so when I'm generating the material, I'll write a sentence maybe on each card, on each slip of paper, and I'll pin it up. And that's an important stage, because then when I read it over, I tend to rush in my first drafts because I'm like excited about where it's going. Like, I want the characters to get to the checkpoint, or to get into bed together, or to get in the fight, like whatever is going to happen. I get excited and I tend to rush a little. So that helps me slow it down when I write it each sentence on a card, and then I can look at it and say, okay, here I can see I kind of missed a sentence here. I could be a little more descriptive about, you know, where his body is. Like, I have to, or here I missed a whole paragraph. You know, she, you know, they really need to have a converse. I summarized this conversation, but this really should be written out as like a scene where they're having the dialogue. So I'll do that. And that's a whole stage. And then at some point it all comes down when I type it up, print it out, cut out each paragraph, and affix each paragraph like that. And at that stage, it's less about generating material and more about giving myself like an overview of the chapter and the rhythms in that chapter, and like the concerns being like attended to. So if I'm looking at it up on my wall like that, and I notice that maybe 3/4 of the way through the story, I introduce one of the main anxieties of the narrator is that, or of like the person whose point of view we're in, is that she, has an anxious relationship with her mother. But I introduce that 3/4 of the way through, and I can see that it's like 3/4 of the way through. I'll sort of sense, you know, that's a little late. Like, I want to do the reader the favor of cueing them into that earlier, so that they're sensing that sort of underneath the chapter the whole time. I don't want to hold that till 3/4 of the way through. And it's true, like, I could see that on my computer screen, but when something's on your screen, you kind of get just pulled into the sentence. It's sort of hard to see maybe like the larger sort of rhythms and movements of the story, and where do certain threads come in, and what information is the reader getting, and when. And somehow when it's up on the wall and you can see it almost in terms of inches, like how many inches into the story does it come through?
You must have a very big wall.
Well, I have a very big wall and very few house guests. So I take over the space, and it does look a little bit like I'm hunting a serial killer or something.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've seen a few scenes like this in Criminal Minds, but this was
exactly.
So, Chuck, I have to ask you, when you wrote Bloody Confused, were there index cards and lovely pieces of paper and string and clothespins on your wall?
Not a one. But I wonder with Rebecca, because I spent 2 years in Abu Dhabi writing about sports, you know, crucial things like golf and Formula One and soccer, none of the trivialities like you're addressing in your book.
Someone has to do the heavy lifting.
Yeah. Okay, so the joke kind of worked. Okay. but I went back there a while later to do a project on female athletes in the region and how it's kind of building. And I got all this blowback of how dare you live there 2 years, you know. And I wonder if you had any fear of interlopers, fear as you went along, or did you set that aside, or did it just not strike you like that?
No, of course. I mean, I think I felt that it was in part my job to problematize for myself my decision to be, is as you say, an interloper, and a white Jewish woman at that. So someone who is very much inhabiting the hegemony of Israel. So to come in and to write Palestinian characters is a risk, but not even a risk on my own behalf. If I got it wrong, sure, I would reveal the limits of like my empathetic imagination, but the lives of people who could be essentially erased by that, you know, it wouldn't be me that would be erased. It would be Palestinians who are in so many ways face erasure of their past, their present, their future. I think terrified less that I would be criticized for my decision to write outside of my position, but that I would get it so wrong that it would be in effect an act of violence. And I still worry about that, but I think it's good to worry about it. I think it's productive. And I think like welcoming conversations about it is important. Like I felt in the end that I didn't have to do it perfectly because I couldn't, but I had to ask myself, not do I have the right to do this, but mm-hmm. if I were to do this, how would I do it with the most integrity? And I think letting that be my guiding question also makes it so I think when I have conversations, it won't be, oh, did you have a right to do this or not? But, you know, how might you have done this better? And I would like to know, actually. Yeah.
Talk about you reached out to a lot of people and you worked with a lot of teachers you had and researchers, but did that help you achieve the integrity you were looking for?
I mean, I suppose we're at the point where someone else will be the judge, but yes, absolutely. I mean, it would have been impossible for me to even imagine, to have the audacity to attempt this book if I hadn't had teachers in all kinds of forms. My language teachers of Hebrew and Arabic at Tel Aviv University and Hebrew mm-hmm. University and the University of California. And I even now actually have a wonderful Arabic tutor. Hi, Omar. And I think I also was really in effect educated by Palestinians and Israelis who invited me into their homes. Mm-hmm. I mean, the hospitality of the region is not overstated. Yeah. Everything you've heard is true and more. Yeah. You know, you'll be fed relentlessly and people will really share with you. The culture of hospitality is beautiful and I think actually has made me a more gracious host. When I can have people in my home again, I will take down the clotheslines and really know how to welcome them. But certain families really sort of let me, in a sense, integrate into their families. In particular, families, I think, one on a kibbutz in North Israel, another family in the Palestinian city of Bethlehem.
And have they read the book? And have they told you what they think?
Not yet. Not yet. It's a little tricky to get it over there, especially into the West Bank. But they're going to, and I'm really excited. I'm nervous too, of course.
Sure.
But
one of the things that struck me again, because there are, and I don't want anybody to be intimidated by this, because you become fascinated with every character in the book, with every person in the book, from every walk of life. And it would be very easy for your moral judgments, not yours, but, you know, like me, be very easy for my moral judgments to come out in some of those characters. But it doesn't. And you know, this topic, this issue of Israeli-Palestinian conflict has been with us for a long, 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 long time. And it would be so easy to allow a character to just have the obvious cliche opinions on things. But again, they're just people just trying to live their lives. But was it an effort to keep the morality out of it? Or was that not even an issue?
I think, yes, it was an issue keeping essentially myself out of it as much as I could. I mean, I'm not like apolitical or anything, but I think I really had to... going back to that question, like, what would it take to do this with integrity? It would be to, I mean, I think I really had to write each character on their own terms. And that meant a lot of things, but one was that no character could be enlisted to be like a symbol of their, of their political stance or of their religion or of their ethnicity. And make them essentially someone who's performing for a reader. But really always root myself in the interior life of that character. So that could be not even the most, what's not rooted in what's most interesting to me about that character, but what is most critical to that character? What is that character afraid of losing? Mm-hmm. What does that character most desperately want to protect? And rooting each character in that. So for example, there's a East Jerusalem Palestinian girl named Mai. She's in her first year of university. What's interesting to me about her sort of position is that she's a Palestinian who lives in East Jerusalem. So she's technically not a citizen of any country and has a kind of idiosyncratic statelessness that's reflected in the complications of the bureaucracy and like all the paperwork she has. Mm-hmm. And it truly is. I'm so sorry to use this word, but it really is Kafkaesque. and so like that to me, when I was excited about working with her as a character, is what I was thinking of. Mai is thinking about her first year at university. She's thinking about refining her aesthetic. Like maybe she wants to go with pearls, but like maybe that's a little too much. She's thinking about how there's a lot more distance now in her relationship with her sister, since her sister got married and is now pregnant and living in her husband's home. And she's excited about growing up and yet already feels such nostalgic pangs for childhood. So I think when I was writing that character, you know, remembering that what's important to her and what she's thinking about should be guiding how that chapter unfolds and what I say from her point of view.
Is there a character, we can't ask you who your favorite character is, that's right, but is there one with whom you relate the most, to whom you relate the most?
I mean, I think, you know, each character, I really did have to find like an entry point. I really did have to find like something we share. And from there, I could go off. I could lose myself in them. I could, which I don't know, there's a real pleasure in it. I find getting lost, disappearing a little. It's kind of like falling in love every time, to be honest. So really there was something in each character, which could be quite disturbing. If the character was particularly a violent, ideological person, and there are more than a few, that was difficult. Uh-huh. But I think recently I've been kind of missing. She's not a major character, but there's a woman named Miriam who is a religious woman, a mother. She has a teenage son. Religious Jewish woman, and she sort of coaches young brides in the sort of Jewish law related to marriage, and she's very happily married, and there's a lot of complications, I guess, in the book, and I'm sort of interested in miscommunication, and you know, I don't often, I have to admit, give my characters a break. Like I always want them to be a little agitated or to have just lost something or to be kind of like to catch them off guard. But with her, like I sort of enjoyed how coddled she was in this happy marriage with this career she loves. And I think like her willingness to really like let her partner be good to her and to base a relationship in like mutual goodwill. It just like felt really good existing in that marriage whenever I did briefly. And you know, that was always kind of a nice break.
All right. I want to get you out on this wonderful book, City of a Thousand Gates, with this, which is the dedication. So I'll read this dedication. I'll butcher it. But it seemed, even though outside in the world the high drama of history might be going on, that this, for all its painful aspects, was one of the moments for the sake of which God had created the earth. Robert Musil, The Man Without Qualities. What's the meaning behind that dedication?
Well, in a way, I didn't feel exactly like it was, I couldn't outright, it wasn't my book exactly to dedicate outright to anyone. You know, there's so many lives and stories that aren't my own, even if I generated them into fiction. Like it felt like it would be sort of fraudulent for me to say, oh, I let myself disappear into these stories, but I put my stamp right on the dedication page. Although then again, I put my name on the cover, so who knows. But I think for me, that book, The Man Without Qualities, there's both a kind of a personal reason and a literary reason. Uh-huh. But I'll only tell you one. Which do you want to know? No, I'm just kidding. So The literary reason is that I think the idea of history unfolding and these intimate moments happening within it. And that exactly as you said near the beginning, that by going intimate, going as intimate as possible into the moments of domesticity or of intimacy, like between a couple or moments of childhood, that inside these moments, like that is history. And that is where the history of the world is unfolding quietly and largely unrecorded. And I felt that in reading that novel and a long time ago, and I think sort of used it as a standard, I suppose.
Nice.
And the more personal reason is that my late grandfather, Louis Sachs, I said his name just to say it.
It's a great name.
He's a great name.
It's a great name.
He was really the first person to make me feel like that my mind was special and I should cultivate it. And he gave me books from a very young age. And we would talk about them, and he always took my opinion seriously. And, you know, that mattered very much when I was a kid, because you can never get adults to take you seriously. And he passed away long before I even started this novel. But that book, The Man Without Qualities, is a favorite of his. So I think it was sort of a gesture towards him and to the sort of the door he opened for me.
Nice. We're glad he opened the door.
I should have said the gate. Oh no. Oh,
we can redo it.
We'll fix it in post. Don't worry.
Fix it in post. How? Okay. So I think this is going to set a standard, Rebecca, for anybody who writes about the Middle East. I really do. Fiction, nonfiction. It's really remarkable. And I think it makes a very complex issue so accessible. And I mean that in a good, accessible is a very good word for me. But what's next? What could you possibly tackle after this? Hopefully it's something to do with dogs or cats, because I think you need a break. I think you need.
I should take a break. I mean, I'm my dog, who I adopted almost exactly a year ago, is snoozing a few feet away from me, and I would love to write about her. You know, I'm not sure, but I think recently I think whereas in this novel, in City of a Thousand Gates, I'm really layering voices. Yeah. Recently, I've become more in what I'm sort of fiddling around with in secret is layering time. I'm like kind of like thinking about not in a science fiction sense, although I love science fiction. I'm just too obsessed with the world I'm in, I think, but layering time, I think in a relationship, and thinking about how we sort of narrativize a relationship between ourselves. And, you know, every relationship really is its own little country, I think, mm-hmm. in a way. So I think that's where my attention is going, but
nice. Come back with it. Thank you so much for being with us. I really hope everybody gets City of a Thousand Gates at your favorite independent bookstore. Really fabulous. Simon Winchester made me feel really stupid a couple of weeks ago. This one is making me feel very small, very, very small, but in a good way. So thank you for being with us. Rebecca, stay with us. I'm going to do a tiny bit of housekeeping, and then we have a little segment we call Deserted Island, which I know you can do off the top of your head.
Great.
So the housekeeping is this. Everybody download us, follow us, review us on Apple iTunes if you're feeling nice. Send us emails and come back next week. We have Robert Jones Jr., son of Baldwin and author of The Prophets. Another amazing, amazing book. So Deserted Island, I'm still in the throes of Valentine's Day. I don't know if people can see. There are my flowers. So Deserted Island is, what is your favorite love story? And I'm going to do alphabetical order again. So it'd be Chuck, David, Rebecca, Tori. Chuck, favorite love story, a book.
It made me realize that as I read,
you don't mostly, have one.
As I read mostly nonfiction, I'll bet the last time I read it was when it was assigned to me.
Great.
So I'm going back to like Longfellow's Evangeline and the river scene. The river scene just stuck with me. Wow. It just made me realize it's been a long time.
Well, you can change that.
I suppose I can.
You're going to have another 30 flights this year. You can change that.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. David?
As I am a 3H romantic, helpless, hapless, hopeless, I go back.
I'm going to get you a t-shirt.
Thank you. I go back to, and it is a book I read probably in the eighth grade, Chuck, but it stuck with me and it's stupid. And that's probably me. It describes me. Summer of 42 by Hermann Rauscher.
I mean,
what 13-year-old boy hasn't fallen in love with somebody who's 16 or 17 and just felt like that gulf wasn't even a gulf. It was an ocean between the two of you. And I know that kid because I was that kid.
Oh, so. David, I love that one.
Yeah.
I love that. That's very nice. That's better than Chuck's. Rebecca, do you have a favorite love story?
Oh, I love love stories. I can't get enough. But the one I'm thinking of is The End of the Affair by Graham Greene.
Oh, yeah.
Julianne Moore played.
I have
in the film movie.
I for favorite books, I have so much trouble letting anyone else into my imagination of them. I'm very like defensive. So, but yeah. And just, I don't know the whole idea of like the wreckage after love.
That's I love. A good one. Okay. Mine's Dr. Zhivago.
Oh,
I mean, who knows why when I was young, for reasons there was nobody in my family, but anyways, all things Russia, that whole thing just fascinated me. And I read Dr. Zhivago. It was probably the first real book that wasn't assigned to me that I read. And it's like, oh, the things people will do for love, right? My brain keeps going back to Rebecca saying every relationship is like a country. I'm trying to think, my husband and I, North Korea, South Korea. Okay.
Liechtenstein,
exactly. Oh, spectacular. All right, Rebecca Sachs again. The book is City of a Thousand Gates. Everybody, please, please get this book. You will not regret it. It's fabulous. Claude, thank you for doing everything. David, Chuck, great to see you. Everybody, please stay healthy, wash your hands, wear a mask, even if you've been vaccinated. And if you have, I'm very happy for you. I don't make anybody feel guilty about the vaccine. Very happy for you. But stay well, everybody, and we will see you next week.